So let's continue our lectures on, as I said, somehow advanced topics in quantum field theory. So let me remind you what is my idea for the structure of these 3 weeks. So the first important topic in quantum field theory, which is very general, although we explored it in the context of matrix models, is the notion of large N expansion, where the diagrammatic expansion organizes itself into planar diagrams, diagrams that you draw in a torus, and so on. And in particular, in matrix models, we saw that sometimes we can sum this class of models. Sum all the planar diagrams, sum all the non-planar diagrams, all the torus diagrams, all the torus with two handles, and so on. Then, you had some lectures by John on this other quantum field theory tool, which is the property that some quantum field theories, the ones which are more understood are conformal field theories, have an alternative description, which is particularly useful at strong coupling, which is given by a theory of gravity in Hunter de Sitter. Okay, and again, this is a tool, a property of some quantum field theories. And in this week, I want to tell you about some other observables that you can consider in quantum field theories, which are some non-local observables. They are loops in quantum field theory. So you are used to operators which depend on some point, on some space-time, some local operator. You put at some point, you put some other operators, and you start computing correlation functions. But there are other operators which, instead of asking for a point, they ask for a loop. Okay? So it's not a property of a point, it's like of a loop. And these are Wilson loops, and we'll study these loops in quantum field theory. We will start by saying, why do we study them? So there will be several motivations. We will show that they are important probes for describing confinement, amplitudes. They are nice observables. They describe propagation in the presence of an external field. So there's a huge motivation that we will see throughout these lectures. And once we will be happy with these objects and eager to compute them, we will do that. How do we compute them? Well, by computing directly using perturbation theory that I did not even list. And then there are the funnier parts, the funnier ways of computing it, using either ADS-CST, using lattice gauge theory, using localization, using several methods that we will see. Okay. So, maybe before, since I think that it is indeed a cool computation, I would like very, very briefly to still do 10 more minutes of matrix models, okay? Just to finish up what we did last time. So we saw our goal in the example that we were studying was to compute a particular observable. So we were computing 1 over z, z is the partition function, integrating over matrices. This was a zero-dimensional quantum field theory. Then we had an observable, which was 1 over n trace of e to the m. This is like our observable. And then we have e to the minus something like 2 over g square trace of m square. Okay? Good. Let me remind you how we did it. So what we did to compute this was first to notice that here we have n square variables. The size of the matrices is n. And the first smart thing we did was to say that this is an integral over just n variables. Okay, this being the eigenvalues of m, because as you see, this is all invariant by conjugation, so the only real gauge invariant data are the eigenvalues. So this is cool. It's already only n variables. And then we add e to the lambda 1, okay, or rather we have 1 over n sum over I e to the lambda I coming from this trace. But since all of them are equivalent, we can keep just one, say e to the lambda 1. Then we add e to the minus this trace, which is 2 over g square, sum over I, lambda I square. And then there was a Jacobian which was a determinant over I and j lambda I to the power j minus 1. So this is a Jacobian. This determinant was square, actually, from the change of variables. Okay? Good. Is everything clear for everyone? Then what did we do? We saw that determinant of lambda j to the power I plus 1 is equal to determinant of any polynomial of degree j, of the degree I, sorry. Yes? Sorry? I want to compute this average here, right? So I want to compute average of e to the lambda 1 plus average of e to the lambda 2 plus average of e to the lambda 3. But all lambdas are equivalent. It's just a labeling. You have a Zn symmetry. There's nothing special about lambda 2 or lambda 5, so I keep just one of them. Just when you want to compute the average of some component in spherical symmetric, you pick whatever component you want and you put 1 over 3, the usual kind of tricks that you do in classical mechanics.
So the lambdas are the eigenvalues?
The lambdas are the eigenvalues of M. So there are n of them, and of course there is a symmetry in just relabeling what you call the n eigenvalues. So we use this trick, and then we chose this pi cleverly. Okay? So that integral d lambda 2 d lambda n become trivial. So we chose these polynomials to be admit polynomials, which have orthogonal measure with respect to the Gaussian. And we are left with integral d lambda 1 of something. And this is the final result. At this point, we are happy. We don't want to simplify it anymore. Just one integral. It's an integral representation for the final result. That's okay. Then we saw that it could be expressed in terms of Bessel functions and so on, but okay, that's already a detail. At this point, we should be happy. Okay? So we went to n squared variables, to one integral with some parameters. Any question on this that we saw last time? So what was the result? The result, when we expand in n, when n goes to infinity, we got an expansion. We got 2 over square root lambda times some Bessel function, I1 of square root lambda, plus, then there was 1 over n squared. This was the sphere diagrams. Then we had the torus diagrams. 1 over n squared multiplied by another function of lambda, lambda over 48, another Bessel function, I2 of square root of lambda, plus dot, 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 where lambda was g square n. Okay? So we managed to resum all these diagrams. Okay. So I want to show you another way, which is the way that typically when you will find a matrix model, this is basically what you will need to do. Because typically you will be interested in only the planar diagrams. So I want to show you a shortcut for getting to this Bessel function. Okay? Okay, so we want to take n to infinity and keep only the planar diagrams. Okay, good. So what we do is say that what we want to compute, let me call it, say, x. Okay, x is a bad name. We want to compute 1 over z integral d lambda 1 d lambda n e to the lambda 1 e to the sum over I, that is 2 over g square, lambda I square. And now, let me write it in the following way, plus twice sum over I smaller than j log of lambda I minus lambda j. Okay? Is this clear? I don't know if you remember, but we saw that actually this Jacobian, before writing it in this way, it came as a product of lambda I minus lambda j. Right? We saw that this Jacobian was equal to a product over I smaller than j, lambda I minus lambda j squared. And for this computation, I prefer to use this form of the Jacobian. So how do we interpret now this integral? Let's forget about the observable for now and focus on this action. So this is like some effective action for this eigenvalue is lambda. So how does it look like? It looks like there is a potential energy, like you have some, think of these lambdas as positions. Okay? So we think as lambdas are positions. Can we turn off the heating, please? Okay. Okay, so lambdas are positions. Then this is like some potential energy. They are in some harmonic oscillator potential. Okay, so this is like some potential for these particles. So lambda I are positions of n particles. Then, this lambda I square, I will call it a potential energy for particle I. And this stuff here, I will call some interaction energy. Some V interaction between particle lambda I and lambda j, and here some potential energy for particle lambda I. Okay? What is the idea? Find the configuration that minimizes this action. In other words, do saddle points. So why would saddle point be a good approximation? Why should we have some integral over lambda i's, and I'm telling you, find the position of the lambda i's which extremize this action, and the integral is given by the value at that extremum. That's what you do for saddle points, right? When you have some saddle points, some integral that you want to compute by saddle point. Okay? So let's do it, and let's check that it is consistent as we go. So let's see that at the value where this is an extremum, this is huge, and therefore the saddle point is very good. Okay? The rough idea is that how many terms you have here? You have a sum of n squared terms. So each lambda I fills the potential of all the... each lambda I fills n particles interacting with it. So for each lambda I, it's like the potential is of order n. So for each integration lambda I, you think that in the exponent you have n. You see? Because for each lambda I, effectively, you see in the exponent lambda I interacting with everyone else with coefficient 1. And you sum up to n for each lambda I. So for each lambda I indeed sees a huge exponent. But we will see it explicitly that indeed it's big. Okay. So the saddle point condition, the derivative of lambda I with of this effective action equal to 0 gives us what? It gives us 4 over g squared lambda I plus sum over j not equal to I 1 over lambda I minus lambda j, or maybe 2, is equal to 0. Okay? Now I'm not being very... okay. Okay, so 2 is equal to 1 now. Don't worry about factors of 2. Okay? So this is what we get. So you have a sum up to n. Okay? So let's see. Let's say that lambda I scales like n to some power alpha. What is alpha? So you have n to the alpha here. And n to the alpha must scale as this one, which is 1 over n to the alpha But there are n terms times n. And therefore, alpha is equal to 1/2. And if alpha is equal to 1/2, the effective action at lambda at the critical point is of order n, and saddle point is good. Okay, good. Now, is this equation familiar? It should be. And I can't blame other lecturers for that. Is this equation familiar? We saw it. I showed it. I wrote this equation like 4 months ago or 6 months ago when I first saw it. This was the equation for the zeros of the wave function of the harmonic oscillator. What was the solution? Well, the Hermite polynomial, because we know that the wave functions of the harmonic oscillator, the zeros are the Hermite polynomial. So this lambda i's, we know what they are. Lambda I are the zeros of some Hermite polynomial n with, okay, they scale like m, so it should be lambda over square root of n with some number. Okay, cool. Well, I'm not sure. Here I'm not, okay, sorry. About factors of n, I'm not sure. Because when n is big, I'm not sure how the zeros of the Hermite polynomial scale. Okay? Doesn't matter. They are the zeros of some Hermite polynomial, lambda times something, which some factors which might depend on n and certainly depend on g and so on. Now, these lambdas, lambda 1, lambda 2, up to lambda n, when n goes to infinity, they have some distribution. Rho of lambda, right? They are distributed in some way. Do you remember what rho of lambda was? Does someone remember what was the distribution of eigenvalues of the Hermite polynomial when n is big? In other words, if you put particles which interact in this way, they are charged, they have this potential. So let's try to guess what the plot should be. So you have particles. Let's now think of this as an electrostatic equilibrium position. So they have this force, which is basically attracting it linearly to the origin. Okay? So particles, they have some force which attracts them linearly to the origin. So they would like to go to the origin. So there is some potential, which is a parabola, and all the particles would like to go to the origin. Okay, this lambda I, so all lambda I would be here if the interaction potential was set to zero. Okay? But then we turn on the interaction of particles, so they start repelling themselves. And because they start repelling themselves, the real distribution of particles will be something like this. So the particles will separate a bit because they will not all go to the minimum because of the interaction. And this would be something like the plot of rho of lambda. Okay? Is this okay? We derived what rho of lambda was. Does someone remember? Or so we saw that this curve was nothing but square root of, if this is a square minus lambda square. Okay? And therefore, let me only write the final result. What we get is that our integral is equal to an integral d lambda. So if you want to compute this observable, all this saddle point does is it fixes some density of eigenvalues. So all you need is to average this observable with respect to that density. which is equal to this, is equal to integral, let me now put all the factors of pi correctly, and then you can do it more carefully, integral, there is a 2, dx over pi, e, since lambda scales like square root of n, I decided to rescale it, and I'm integrating from x, minus 1 to 1, square root of 1, minus x squared, this is nothing but lambda, and this is the definition of this Bessel function. Okay, so I know that I skipped many of the details, but basically the idea is quite simple, which is that you have some effective action which depends on eigenvalues, you find the equilibrium position. The equilibrium position is just a guess of particles which have some interaction potential and some potential energy. You minimize it, you find some density. In this case, the density is just a circle, a semicircle law, or Wigner law. It's just a square root. And then your average, you just average with respect to that density e to the lambda. And that gives precisely the Bessel function. Notice that this picture, you could do it now if you'd have a cubic interaction. Okay, you'd have a cubic interaction, okay, who cares? That just means that now the potential is not just a parabola, it's a parabola now, it's another shape of potential. You would just need to study particles with electrostatic interaction and another potential. But in principle, the physical picture is the same. Different potentials here. The interaction is always the same because it comes from the Jacobian. What changes when we study different matrix models is the potential. And you just need to start two-dimensional charged particles in arbitrary potentials. And it's a quite simple problem. You find the configuration that minimizes this electrostatic problem, and that configuration dominates, and then you just need to integrate any observable that you want. If it was not e to the lambda, if it was another thing, you'd put here another function. Okay? Good. So this method is quite general, and it applies for any matrix model, not only Gaussian, anything. Okay, good. So it took me considerably longer than I thought. Okay, that's life. Was it clear? Is it clear? Yeah. Yes. Right. So we were doing, n was what was telling us that a saddle point was good. It was the fact that n was large that told us that we could do the saddle point. If we would now keep corrections to the saddle point and so on, we'll get an expansion in 1 over n. Okay? If you would go beyond the saddle point and say, okay, now I keep the derivatives and so on, blah, 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 then you would get a 1 over n expansion. So keeping only the saddle point means doing the leading order thing in n, which you know is the planar diagrams. Yeah? More questions? Yes?
When we have that sum over all j and I, yes, we get like a conjunction of n squared instead of n?
Here? No. Here, I is fixed.
Oh, I is fixed. Okay.
So for each I, we take the derivative with respect to I. Right? When you take the derivative with respect to I, only the terms with I give something, so I is fixed. Is it clear for everyone that I is fixed? You take derivative with respect to lambda I, you only pick the terms where the I that you are taking the derivative appears here. Okay, good. So I hope you memorized that this matrix model gives this Bessel function. Hopefully it will appear. We will derive this in the last lecture. Or in the next to the last lecture. Maybe it will imply that I will need to go over time a few times, but that's okay. Okay, very good. So now I want to motivate, so let's start our motivation for studying Wilson loops. And I want to start my motivation by studying the propagation of a particle from one point x to another point y. Okay, so I want to study the propagation of particle from point x to point y. Okay? So I want to consider the propagator. Okay? Which is just phi of x, phi of y, which is just, as you know, in Fourier, it is just 1 over d squared plus m squared, just some massless field. And we start at position y and we go to position x. Okay? Okay, good. All i's, 2's, minus, etc., as usual, I leave it as an exercise. Just because it would really slow us down to keep track of all of them. And, I mean, we don't gain much. Okay? But okay. While I have them in the notes, I will write them without thinking too much. Very good. So this is basically what we want to compute. So why do I want to compute this? Because I don't know if you ever wondered, but okay, this function you can compute, you can compute, it's just a Fourier transform of 1 over p squared, right? So in momenta, we get just 1 over p squared plus m squared, and that's it. And in position space, you have to do a Fourier transform of this. And then you do Feynman diagrams. You pick particles at given points or with given momentum, doesn't matter, and you start putting propagators, vertices, and so on. Now, this does not look that much as a sum over histories. This does not look like, when you write this, it doesn't look like you are telling me that pick a particle at position x, it goes to position y, sum over all possible histories with some weight, and so on. It doesn't resemble that, this nice physical picture that we have, for example, when we derive the path order formulation of quantum mechanics, where we write a propagator as a path integral from one point to the other. And the formalism where you don't think about propagators, but you think over sums over paths, is what is called the first quantized formalism or worldline formalism, which is what I want to discuss today. Okay? The idea, so we want to write this, our goal is to write this as a sum over paths from x to y, so this is our goal, e to the minus some action which depends on that path. Okay. We will see that this is just something trivial, just a free particle propagating from point x to point y. If you have a free particle, but in the presence of an electric field, of an electromagnetic field, we will see that in order to compute its propagation, we need to compute Wilson loops. And that will be the first motivation. Okay, good. So let's call this guy some propagator, g of x and y. So g of x and y, let's start by doing some simple trick, is equal to some integral from 0 to infinity dt x e to the minus it p squared plus m squared. Okay? So this d squared is nothing but the operator p squared, right? P squared plus m squared, and then y. So first, this formula, is this clear to everyone? Just e to the minus alpha, when you integrate, gives 1 over alpha. So this is a way of writing 1 over that operator. You write it as an integral representation. Okay? Is everyone happy? Is someone happy? Very good. Okay, great. Now, the idea is we break this. So this is like propagation. Okay, now let's do it more explicitly. So now, on the other hand, if I add some xj, e to the I, some small epsilon, p squared plus m squared, some position, xj minus 1. How would I compute it? Let me remind. So basically, I'm redoing now the path integral derivation in quantum mechanics. So I know it's quite basic, but okay. But I mean, if you think it's the idea now, I want to write this as a path integral. Should I do it, or should I just quote the result? Yes. Okay, if you want, I could see if the spectrum is positive, negative, put the sign here so that this is convergent at infinity and so on. But as I told you, minus 1 is equal to 1, so that's kind of hard to do properly at this point. Okay, let me do it. Okay. I wrote it here, so let me. So this would be integral dpj. So our goal will be, we will write this stuff as a product of very small exponentials, many very small exponentials. So we will divide this t into many small epsilons, and then I want to write what the value for each small epsilon is. So I just insert a complete basis here. Okay, this is just inserting the identity, e to the minus I epsilon p squared plus m squared x j minus 1. Okay? So now that p acts on this state, this guy gets out as a number. So this becomes integral dpj e to the minus I epsilon pj squared plus m squared. Because it tips on p, so p is the operator, so it acts on the cat p, it just leaves out as a number. And now I have just the cats, xj, pj, and pj, xj minus 1. So now I just have to evaluate these cats, they just give exponentials, right? They are just what is the momentum cat in position space, and what is the position cat in momentum space. It's just the Fourier transforms. So I get that this is then equal, computing here is integral dpj e to the minus I epsilon pj squared plus m squared plus I pj xj minus 1. And now I just complete the square, okay? So I have pj squared, I have pj, I add and subtract what I need to complete it, I do the Gaussian, and I get e to the minus I epsilon m squared plus I epsilon xj minus 1 over epsilon everything squared times some number, which I don't care. Okay? Is everything clear? Very good. Then our propagator is equal to an integral dt from 0 to infinity. And now I will insert many position space identities, because when I have a position space, I already know how to compute it. So integral dx1, dxn. And then I just have x e to the minus I epsilon t squared plus m squared acting on xn, the same exponential, xn minus 1, up to x1, the same exponential, y. Very good. And what do we see? We see that then this is equal to an integral dt 0 to infinity. All this stuff I define, if you want, integral dx. This curly dx is the integral over all possible x's. And then I have exponential of the sum over all these velocities squared, which is integral from 0 to t dt, and then I have x dot square. There is a 2 here, sorry. But I mean, I don't know why I'm worried about this. Over 4 minus m square. Okay, very nice. So this is our propagator g of x and y. Okay, and this deserves a box. Okay, nice. So this is what we wanted. We saw that the propagator from x to y can be written as an integral over paths. Okay, these paths are such that x of 0 is equal to y, x of capital T is equal to small x. Okay? And they describe the sum over paths where a particle goes from point x to point y, and this is the action of the particle. Okay? The action of a relativistic particle. Okay, good. So we did not rediscover the action. This is really something else. So this is what is called word-line formalism. You write a propagation of a point from one point to the other as really a sum over paths from x to y with the action which depends on the path. So this is exactly what we were after. Okay? Questions about this? No questions? Is it okay? Now, the way we decided to break our t, so we have our interval from 0 to t, our time. So let me recall what is the logic first. Okay, let me do it a bit slower. So the logic is, we have a propagator, and to describe a propagator, I can write this integral representation here. Now, from this point of view, it's clear what to do. What is this? This is exponential of time times an Hamiltonian. What is this Hamiltonian? Just a quantum mechanics Hamiltonian, p squared plus m squared. But you know already how to do path integral in quantum mechanics with Hamiltonian p squared plus m squared. What do you get? You get this. Okay? So I could jump, after doing this trivial step of writing 1 over a as e to the minus a with some integral, I could have said, now it's path integral for quantum mechanics that you did already. Right? This is just usual quantum mechanics, p squared plus m squared. It leads to this. Okay? There would be a potential here, the potential would appear here. You did this quantum mechanics already, right? With the François David problem. Good. Now, when doing this, what did we do? We decided to break this in equal spaces. Okay? But this is our choice. We could have chosen to break this interval from 0 to t in some other crazy way. Provided all these intervals are small, of course. But I could decide to break it in some other crazy way. In other words, I can have a metric on t. Okay? We can have a one-dimensional metric, which is called I always forget, Albine or Einbein or whatever, Albine. E of t. There's some metric here. Does someone know? Albine, Einbein? Einbein. Einbein, not Albine, come on. So an Einbein, such that when I integrate this E of t dt, I get the total length. But in principle, which tells me how to break this integral. Okay? So when you would discretize these small intervals, xj minus xj minus 1, here was epsilon, would now become some epsilon of the t where you are, which is related to the j where you are. Okay? And you would break it in a way that would depend where you are. Okay? Do I have color shock? Yes, I do. So the difference would then be that you would get this Albine would appear here and here. Okay? So this is the same computation with some funny metric. Okay? And this is okay. So, if someone chooses parametrizes this in a different way. So, x. So, if I change t to some f of t, x dot, x dot goes to f prime of t x dot of f of t. Okay? So, if e goes to e times f prime of t, our action is parametrization invariant. Okay? So this tells you, if you choose different parameterization, it just means that you are choosing a different metric which differs from the other metric by this f prime. Okay? So if different people can choose different metrics, and therefore we get all these actions which we saw are related by parameterizations in the way that I wrote, then we might as well be democratic and integrate over all possible such metrics. Okay? So why not integrate over E? Why not, indeed? Then we would say that our propagator, this becomes now a bit formal. If you want, the definition of this is by the discrete, which is what we did. So it's not really very useful for the practical purpose, but conceptually it's quite useful. We would say that we integrate over matrices, over matrix, over x. We divide by the volume of reparametrizations, because we integrate over the matrix, e to the integral dt. We also integrate capital T from 0 to t, x dot square over e minus m square e. Now, e is not propagating. That is, there is no e dot, no derivatives on e. Okay? And this basically means that you can integrate it out. You have a field which is an auxiliary field that doesn't propagate, you can integrate it out. Okay? So this implies we can integrate it out, and the equation of motion, delta S delta E equal to 0, what does it give? It gives x dot square over E square minus m square equal to 0. So it tells you that E is equal to x dot square, square root over x dot square over m. Okay? So that finally our propagator, if you now plug that E back into the action, so finally our propagator, to go from point x to point y, our nice g of x and y is some integral over paths, integral dt, e to the minus, okay, integral dt, I can also say that it's an integral over paths which take different times, so I can also absorb this integral dt in what I mean by paths. Again, this is all a bit formal, I just want to get a nice formula to give us some intuition for what follows. It's not really something that I'm going to use to do computations. But what is this action? When I plug the E inside this formula, I get integral M goes here, square root of x dot square dt. In other words, integral dx e to the minus integral M, integral of the line element. In other words, integral e to the dx e to the minus M length of my path. Cool, and this is the action that you typically write for a relativistic particle, right? The square root of x dot square, the line element. Yes? Oh, you mean the sign here?
No, like 1 plus m or 1 minus
m. 1 plus m. No, both terms give the same. It's just a factor of 2. So let's see. So from this term, you get x dot square over e, and e is square root of x dot square over m. So this gives m times square root of x dot. And this one here is minus m square times e, and e is square root of x dot square over m. So it gives again m times square root of x dot. Okay? And there are signs and so on, and everything. At the end of the day, this is what you get. Okay, this is another nice formula that also deserves a box. And so these two formulas are some neat formulas that tell you that indeed we can do these propagators by summing over paths. Yes?
So we all know that the propagator is quite divergent as x goes to y. So where are those
where's that divergence hiding in this position?
Ah, very good point. So let's see. So no, when x goes to y, okay, that's a very good question. Let me think a bit about it. I think it should be because
just which limits these integrals, I guess, are the u, the n, and the i, r, n.
Okay, that's a very good question for which I should immediately, so let's see. So if they are very close, then, so this is the sum over paths that go from x to y. All the paths will have roughly the same length, which will be very close to zero. And the integration over all these paths will generate a very large phase space volume that would lead to the divergence. But okay, this form is not particularly useful to see all these divergences. But if I would go here, it's as usual. I mean, it's the fact that the fields will, so the fluctuations, the fields that fluctuate a lot dominate. Sorry?
If we select x with y, our length will go to zero. So
yes.
We don't have any x.
Yeah, that's what I said. When x is very small, all the paths contribute in the same way. They roughly contribute with one. And you have all these many paths, and therefore you don't have this suppression that you have when they are very separated apart. So when they are very separated, we see that the length, there is a length which dominates, which is the minimal length, and we recover classical mechanics and so on. When they are very close, I mean, the length is going to zero, and it's not, no, this picture is no longer true, and then we don't have this suppression, as Bruno said. Okay? Very good. So are you all happy with this? So in the tutorial is an exercise about playing exactly with this first quantization and so on, so you will have time to digest it a bit better. So, but for you to be able to do the tutorial, I need to advance a bit more. And this is where the motivation, the Wilson loops will start appearing. We will now study the same problem in the presence of a gauge field. Okay? So now we want to study the propagation of a particle which goes from x to y, and there is a gauge field A, in the presence of a gauge field. What do you suggest to do? How do we add the gauge field? Yes?
Change the derivative to the numerator.
Very good. So what we should do, so to take A into account, we simply need to change the derivative into the covariant derivative. Okay? So d square goes to d mu plus I e a mu square. Okay? So for now we are considering QED. A is a vector, a mu, but it has no matrix structure. It's just QED, just really electrons moving in some magnetic and electric field, really QED. Okay, very good. What changes in our derivation? Ah, it's a pity I erased. Ah, no, it's still here. So what changes in our derivation? Here, instead of this P, okay, let me write the critical, the important step. I should have numbered it, okay. So at some point, when we were computing xj, then we had this small exponential, e to the I epsilon, operator now p plus e a square plus m square on xj minus 1. Okay? Now here, we insert p, and we integrate over p. And now, you can also remove this exponential out, because when you expand and when you lower, A connect there. Okay, let's write the result and then see if it's clear. Because A depends on X, but A acts on X and gives a number. P P acts on P and gives a number, so I can remove it, and I get E to the minus I epsilon M square plus I epsilon xj minus 1 over epsilon square. This was the previous thing. Minus I epsilon A at point A. Okay, there is some index mu, some vector index. A mu at point xj minus 1 times xj minus 1. Okay, times some number, which comes from the Gaussian integration. Okay, but I mean, I don't think there is a point in doing this, right? We just expand this exponential. When an operator depends on the position, acts on the position, it becomes a number. When it depends on moment and it acts on moment, it becomes a number. You just expand, do this carefully, and you get this. Is it okay? I could do it, but it's just, I think it just makes everything more complicated. Okay, very good. So what is it? This is the derivative. And what is this? This is a gauge field coupling to a derivative. Okay. Sorry. This is not an epsilon. This is an E of charge. Sorry, E. So if you want, I can multiply by epsilon and divide by epsilon. Now it looks like a derivative. Okay, very good. So the only thing that changes then is that there is an extra coupling, A coupling with derivative. Yes? So what we get, the only difference here in our formula, let's write it, is that g of x and y is given by this integral e exponential of integral x dot square plus m square plus I e a mu x mu dot. Yes? Sorry, there is a mistake here. X, the point xj minus 1. Sorry. Okay, very good. So this tells you that what you should do is, if you want, I can write this exponential. I can write this as integral dt integral dx exponential of I times my action for my field, the action that was there, times the exponential of the integral of I e a mu dot x dot mu from which the contour that goes from x to y. And this integral, this is the building block of the Wilson loop. So it's the phase acquired by the particle going from x to y in the presence of an external field. Okay? So this part I can also write as integral of s exponential of I integral from a path that goes from x to y, the particular path, the particular contour, e, and then just a, for those that like this more mathematical notation. Okay. Okay. Very good. And let me just remind you of some simple physics. Suppose we study the propagation of a particle from point X to point Y, that it can go through several possible paths, but we put here some solenoid with some magnetic field B inside. Okay? Magnetic field only inside, no magnetic field outside. But there is, of course, as you know, vector potential here, A not equal to 0. Okay? You can think it. There is no B, there is no E, but there is A. And what is the difference of phase acquired going here? What is the difference of the phases? Phase 1 and phase 2. And the difference of these phases, the difference of phase due to the presence of the magnetic field, is the integral going above of I e a mu x dot mu minus I e the integral going below a mu x dot mu, which is nothing but the integral of the contour integral of I e a mu x dot mu, which is nothing but the integral over this surface here using Stokes' theorem of B, which is nothing but the flux. And we see that we get a difference of phase and an interference pattern, which is given by the flux of the B on this solenoid. Okay? And you see that this here, this contour integral here, is a gauge invariant quantity. If you apply a gauge transformation for A, because it's a closed loop, it's a gauge invariant quantity. And it makes sense by the fact that this is an observable thing that we can really observe some difference due to the presence of a solenoid, some difference of phase. Now, finally, yes?
How are Wilson loops different to varied phases?
Sorry?
How are Wilson loops different to varied phases in general?
They are quite different in the sense that I'm going to explain now, which when you will see the... But there is, of course, a very close relation, the Wilson loops that I really want to study are not yet these ones. It's something slightly more interesting, which appears when you have non-abelian gauge theories. And there, I believe, we don't discuss much Berry phases, right? So, I mean... Okay, good. Now, so finally, non-abelian gauge theory. Okay? So now A is a matrix. Okay? So it's a covariant derivative, and A is an non-abelian, it's a matrix. What changes? What changes there if A is a matrix? Almost nothing. But there is one step that changes. What changes here, in this step? The answer is nothing. Why would something change? It's just a matrix, nothing special. Exponential of matrix means 1 plus matrix. Epsilon is small. This guy is small. Right? This is very small, so this is something, this is 1 plus a matrix. So if A is a matrix, here nothing changes. Okay? But here it changes completely. It is not true that when you have exponential of matrix times small parameter times exponential of matrix times small parameter, etc., that is, this is just exponential of matrix. Sorry. So we now have E to the I epsilon A at point xn times x dot at part n E to the I epsilon A of xn minus 1 dot xn minus 1. This is what you get from the previous derivation. Okay? You get all this stuff. E to the I epsilon A of x1 dot x1 dot. Okay, you get something like this. Okay, this is what we get. So same logic as before. But now this is not equal to exponential of the integral of A dot x. Now, A is a matrix. So I have this matrix with indices AB, times this matrix with index BC, etc., times this matrix. Okay, let me write here. A1, A2, with index A2, A3, summation over A2, and here something like AN, AN plus 1, or whatever the counting is. Okay? So I have these matrices, and I multiply them in pieces, where each of them is, of course, roughly 1 plus I epsilon A dot X dot, with indices A1, A2. And I multiply all these pieces, and this is not the same as this exponential of this matrix, where this, by definition, is 1 plus integral of A dot x dot plus 1 half of integral A dot x dot squared plus etc. This is what the definition of this would be. Okay? So this is the definition of exponential of a matrix. And it's not, I mean, as you know, you have this, you have seen this several times, right? In quantum information, in field theory, everywhere, I guess, when you did the path integral for non-abelian gauge fields, right? You have seen that this product of exponentials, e to the a, e to the b, as you know, is not e to the a plus b. Right? Yes? No, if you follow it carefully, the 1 over n's, no, they don't. Typically, you need to be careful when you multiply these operators.
But why? I mean, when you multiply out those factors, 1 plus epsilon, blah, 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 you throw away all the terms that are epsilon squared and higher, then you just get.
No, it's just if you keep the commutators and see powers of n, you really will see that it is not true. So on the other hand, let me finish, then we can discuss. On the other hand, this product, when you treat this is what is the definition of the path order exponential of the integral of A dot x dot. Okay? What do I mean by this path order exponential? I mean precisely this. I break this integral. I have some integral from point x to point y, and this is defined as breaking it in small pieces. And in each piece, I can use the exponential of A. Okay? So this motivates the study of these objects, which are this path-ordered exponential of A dot x dot. Okay. So the Wilson loop that we will see later, which typically depends on some contour C, you have some contour C, is defined to be the trace of the path order exponential of the integral around that loop of A dot x dot. And we have seen the first motivation for studying these objects. If you want to study propagations of particles in the presence of an external field, we have to deal with these kind of objects, these generalized phases, which, because of the non-abelian nature, are defined this way. They are these path-order exponentials, which describe the propagation of particles in the presence of these external fields. If the field was not external, if I would also integrate over the gauge field, then I would have to deal with averages of these objects. Right? All we said was for an external field, thinking that A is external. If A is not external, okay, then we average these guys. And we have to learn how to compute such averages of non-local, of this kind of non-local operators. Okay? So this would be the first motivation. So I think it's probably a good time to stop, and tomorrow we would start at 10 past 12.
Start?
10 yeah. past 12.
Okay. For an hour.
For an hour.
Because any longer we don't get lunch, so we have to.
Okay, thank you. What was the question?
That's a different kind of problem.